Before we get started, a quick shout out, a quick recognition to Dr. Katie Jo Light, my partner in our office, my teammate. She is fantastic. She is an attending who is family medicine OB, who helped bounce back some information with me on this as we're talking about non-pregnant diabetes care. So Dr. Katie Jo, you rock. Thanks, Dr. Light. Hey, hey, podcast family. I have a super interesting topic, well, at least I think it's super interesting, that we're going to cover today that was actually sent to me through the podcast. You can actually leave a voice message. I'd much rather you guys, just FYI, leave a message either through Instagram or Facebook, because it's kind of a pain in the ass to get that voice message through the podcast. Plus, I can't directly respond to you because I don't know how. But I did hear the message. I received this message yesterday, and that became the topic that we're going to discuss today. I bumped something else, and I'll tell you what I bumped in just a minute, because that's super interesting, too. And what I bumped is a little bit controversial, so I'm like, let me just not touch that one for right now and do this one instead. All to say, this is the message that I received yesterday. It went something like this. Hey, Dr. Chapa, can you weigh in on this little debate here? If you have a patient who has type 1 diabetes and is still in the hospital and she is obviously postpartum, what is the best way to follow those sugars? Should it be before meal glucose checks or postprandial glucose checks? Now, when you first hear that, you're like, well, we'll just do either one. No. It actually does matter. It matters if the patient is pregnant. It matters if the patient is not pregnant. Lots of cool stuff to talk about. And we are going to do that in this episode. So here's what we're going to focus on. In a postpartum patient that has type 1 diabetes, should we be checking 2 hours postprandial or even 1 hour postprandial, or the pre-meal, the QAC values before the cada ante comida, the QAC values? It is interesting, and there's an answer. So we're going to cover this in a minute, and we're going to touch on some other fun diabetic stuff here in just a little bit, and including the terminologies that we use. I received a written message, I think it was through Facebook or Instagram. I think it was through the Instagram. And it was from one of our podcast family members who said, you know, I listened to one of your episodes regarding diabetes, and I have to say, it's something that you said made me cringe, and please correct it. And so I'm doing that right now. Now, that's not why I'm doing this episode. I'm doing this because the QAC or the postprandial glucose checks is a fascinating question, and we're going to tackle that here. Anyway, this podcast family member said, I myself have diabetes, and in your episode, you said the diabetic patient. Guys, how many times do we say that, right? Oh, it's that diabetic patient, or your diabetic patient is in room 2. Do y'all get that that actually is not the correct way to address or describe that person? I'm going to explain why in this episode, although I'm sure you have heard the explanation many times before, because I know we've covered that in this very show sometime in the past. So we got lots to tackle here. QAC before meals or postprandial glucose checks or both in a patient who is postpartum and has type 1 diabetes. So let's get into all of this data and why this matters. Lots to cover, guys. Ooh, I got so excited. All right, let's cover this info now. Just trying to keep everyone up to date on evidence-based practice because medicine moves real fast. This is Clinical Pearls.
Mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
First thing first, as I responded to this podcast family member, look, I take every comment to heart, especially when it's constructive criticism, and this person is completely right. See, here's how we all fall into this trap. Hey, our hypertensive patient is here. The preterm labor patient is here. Y'all get that? Where we substitute the condition for the patient's identity. And it's not right. I mean, it reduces the patient to the diagnosis. That's why some have called that it's reductive terminology. Because it's not. It's a person with preterm labor. It's a person with hypertension. And I was guilty of this in one of the past episodes that we did where we covered diabetes care. And I'm sure it's going to slip out in this episode because it's just so entrenched in my stinking head with how I train, is that we talk about diabetic patients. Truth is, we don't have diabetic patients. None of us do. We have patients who are afflicted with diabetes, either type 1 or juvenile onset, or type 2 adult onset, or gestational diabetes. But we really don't have diabetic patients. And I know what you're thinking, man, seriously, is this what we become? Yeah. I mean, how would you like to be called by your diagnosis rather than by who you are, your name? So I get that. And it really was very humbling for me because obviously I didn't mean any disrespect by it at all. But when one of our episodes in the past where we talked about diabetic care, and I said, oh my goodness, you know, in our diabetic patients, and it just flew off the tongue. Now, speaking of that, the message that I received, the voice message that I received that led to this episode, our podcast family member through that message said the exact same thing, said, hey, I've got a question, Dr. Chapa. In our type 1 diabetics who are still in the hospital and postpartum, should we be checking pre-meal or postprandial sugars? It's a great question, and it does matter, and I'm going to explain why in this episode and why it's different than what is done during pregnancy, and we'll tackle that data in a minute. But she said, "And what should we do in our patients who are postpartum and are type 1 diabetics?" So I just want to be very clear, and right off the bat, the proper terminology that we all should be teaching ourselves, teaching our residents, our fellows, medical students, is that we really don't have diabetics. We have patients with diabetes. And I know, if you want to just call it semantics and go, whatever, I get that. I encourage you not to, because it is the right thing to do. So if it slips in this episode, sorry, I am being super, super aware of it, but I got so much to cover and I'm sure it's going to slip out at some point. Anyway, now you can talk about diabetic care. Diabetic care is a treatment plan. Diabetic care is different than talking about the diabetic patient. Does that make sense? So when we say, you know, I've looked up the data on diabetic care postpartum, well, that's fine. I mean, that's diabetic referring to a treatment plan, not necessarily to the person. So it's all in context, all right? Ooh, none of this is what I wanted to talk about, but it did have an important place in what we're talking about here. So we're going to be talking about, and the question specifically asked regarding patients with type 1 diabetes. Guys, that's a big deal. Type 1 diabetes who are now postpartum. What to do? So lots to cover. I just wanted to set that stage, let that settle in, and then we're going to get to the data right now. Oh my goodness, you want to make it even more skin crawling? And I've done this too, but it wasn't long ago at one of our clinical sites. One of our nurses said, hey, your next patient here is a prisoner. Now, what that means is she's in custody and she has a guard, right? Because we take care of that patient population. And I was like, my patient's a prisoner of what? She's a prisoner. You mean she's in custody? I said, well, yeah, that's what I mean. Do you see how easy it is, guys? How just, again, and my nurse wasn't trying to be derogatory. I mean, she's in an orange jumpsuit, for heaven's sakes, with shackles on her feet, which makes me uncomfortable even in and of itself. But rules are rules. So, and then we had that discussion back then. Like, hey, let's probably not call her a prisoner. It's probably not cool with that. Even though she's in custody, let's just say our pregnant patient who is in custody. And it's work, guys. I'm telling you, it's to with all the other stuff we got to keep in our heads and all the ordering and what panel are we getting and do we miss anything? I get that. You know, little terminology like this is probably on the last of our list, but it really does matter. And it may not matter too much to us. I promise it matters to the patient. Well, now that we've beaten that horse to death. Now let's get into what we were supposed to be talking about. So when we're talking about diabetes care in the peripartum interval, we really have three boxes, right? Before pregnancy, where hopefully they have their hemoglobin A1C under control because that's tied to miscarriage and malformations, and that's a big deal. And then there's pregnancy care itself, and then there's postpartum care. Now, the question that this family member asked is about patients with type 1 diabetes. That's totally different, and they have different needs than even our type 2 diabetes patients, because they have different requirements based on their basal level of insulin. Type 1 has very low basal level of insulin, so they have different demands and expectations. So keep that in mind. So type 1 is totally different. Type 2, you've got a little more flexibility because they have insulin. It's just insulin resistant, and that's working in a whole different way. And then, of course, you've got gestational diabetes. We're going to try to tackle each one of these specifically intra-pregnancy, so during pregnancy itself, and then postpartum. And I want to cover all of those. We're going to focus on gestational. I want to talk a little bit about type 2 and then our type 1s, because type 1s is a little bit, is of the three, those are the most confusing, okay? Now, I have to say here that we're talking about finger sticks, capillary blood glucose. Okay, so remember, this isn't plasma draws. It's not venipuncture. It's just typical finger stick, the old little Hemacue, you know, the dextrose sticks, the D-sticks, whatever you call it. Every place calls them different. So finger sticks, okay? Those are capillary blood glucoses. Well, the way to get around these finger stick issues is, of course, to use a continuous glucose monitor, a CGM. Continuous glucose monitors are the bomb. And I've covered this many times again in past episodes. But remember, that's a whole different thing. While it correlates very closely to capillary blood glucose, it's not. Remember that all of these Dexcom, not a sponsor, or all of these wearables, they're not measuring the glucose in the vasculature. It's measuring the glucose in the interstitial fluid. And there's a little bit of differences in how it responds to a meal. It's not the same thing as a finger stick. But that's the easiest, because you don't have to stick yourself at all. I mean, you're just like, hey, I wonder what my sugar's doing. Put your phone up to the thing. Bing. There's an on-demand read. Fantastic. Fantastic. Our poor patients with especially type 1 diabetes that we ask to do multiple checks during the day. I mean, I feel for them. My goodness. Fight for those patients. Call the insurance, write a letter, fax whatever, and go, no, this person needs, you need to pay for this patient's continuous glucose monitor. I mean, it just, please do. Now, the world is totally different because now you can get a continuous glucose monitor even without a prescription. They're available over the counter without all the bells and whistles. So it's like a CGM light, okay? But that's the way we avoid all this. And so what I was going to respond back, but I couldn't figure out how to do a voice memo on the podcast to send back to our podcast family member was, well, the way we avoid all this is slap on a continuous glucose monitor. I mean, if you can get one, damn, that's the easiest, because then you can get the ideal on a patient with type 1 diabetes is fasting, pre-meal, postprandials, and at bedtime. Because it doesn't hurt, because she's wearing a wearable. That is the best way to do it. But in those patients that don't have a CGM and have to do a manual sticks, this is a good question. Remember, our main focus is on patients with type 1 diabetes because they have very low basal insulin values. And then we've got to titrate that, we titrate their insulin based on their needs, okay? So it does matter. It matters that the patient has type 1 diabetes as opposed to type 2 adult onset diabetes, because that's, again, more of an insulin resistant issue, and how you measure those sugars is going to be different. So let's make a couple assumptions here. One, we're assuming, of course, that the patient does not have a CGM because the question was specific about finger stick for capillary blood glucose. Okay. So the question is, should we do pre-meal or post-meal, specifically in the patient with type 1 diabetes? And we're going to answer all of this. Where was I going with this? I've already lost my whole train of thought. Oh, CGM. CGMs are the bomb. And I would ideally hope that in the future, all insurances, including a public assistance like CMS, covers those darn things, because picking yourself four times a day is pretty ridiculous. Now, the best, the maximum way for a patient with type 1 diabetes who needs tight control is 7 times a day. That would we be asking them, up to 8. Think about it. Once in the morning, that's fasting. Pre-meal and then after meal, whether it's 1 or 2 hours, and there's 3 meals in a day scheduled. So that's 6, that's 7. So 6 throughout the meals, pre and post. And then fasting. And then another one at night, QHS, that is 8 times in a day. Pincushion. I mean, my goodness, we would ask patients, ideally, we want that many for a patient with type 1 diabetes, because the most comprehensive view of what's going on is the adjustment value pre-meal. And we're going to talk about that. It's called the medication setting. How much insulin do you need to give, typically ultra rapid, to prepare you for the meal coming in? Remember, type 1 diabetes don't have that pancreas to kick it out. So you've got to prepare for the meal by giving yourself an injection. And if your pre-meal glucose is already super low, then you would give yourself less of that value. Does that make sense? And if it's super high, then you give yourself a little bit more to cover the bolus of carbohydrate, the meal that's coming in. So in patients with type 1 diabetes, the pre-meal value is typically to anticipate the response and the amount of insulin that you're going to need for your meal. And then, again, in a perfect world, you would check either 1 or 2 hours after that. And we're going to tell you the target goals here in a minute, of course, which we all know. 1 hour, well, let's just do it now. 1 hour postprandial is less than 140. In general, for tight control, 2 hours is ideally less than 120. Although outside of the pregnancy world, it gets a little bit more loosey-goosey and some give it a little bit more leeway. But in general, very tight control is 1 hour less than 140 and the 2 hour less than 120. Fasting and preprandial, your goal should be anywhere from 70 to 95, right? So you use a pre-meal D-stick to try to figure out, to try to guesstimate how much pre-meal ultra-rapid insulin you're going to use rather than regular insulin to cover that meal right away. But in a perfect world, you do that, and then you check 1 or 2 hours after to see how your body handled it, and then you go forward the rest of your day. So remember, these are the assumptions here, that these patients do not have a CGM, a continuous glucose monitor, and that they're okay with multiple finger sticks throughout the day. And look, we should all be very respectful and in awe of patients who are willing to stick their fingers multiple times during the day. My goodness. Like I said, you know, ideally we've got like 7 or 8 points in a day, fasting and then pre-meal, post-meal for 3 meals, and then again at night. That's a lot to ask for a patient. That's a lot to ask for anybody. I'm telling you, if I had type 1 diabetes, I'm in big trouble, because if I don't have a CGM with my distractiveness in my nature, I'm missing sugars. I know that's a terrible thing to say. I'm just real. I'm just being very real with you. It's going to get away from me. So I have a lot of respect for patients that have to do this and self-monitor very, very closely. You also need to monitor very closely with adult onset type 2 diabetes, but that's a little different, because there you already have insulin. You just want it, your body to recognize that you have it, which is why you give metformin, sulfonylureas, or insulin sensitizers of that type, okay? However, even though they do have basal insulin secretion, unlike a patient with type 1 diabetes, there is value here to target pre-meal glucose checks. And again, we haven't even gotten into that so much, but the short of it is, if you're not pregnant, pre-meal glucose checks is the way to go, okay? QAC and QHS. Now, ideally, it's fasting QAC, which is before every meal, and QHS at night. That's the goal. So the two bookends, well, first thing you do when you wake up, last thing you do when you go to bed, and then before each meal. That is the universal when you're not pregnant. Pregnancy focuses on postprandial values because it's linked to better perinatal outcomes, mainly less macrosomia, and even in some studies, less risk for preeclampsia. Right. So this is why in pregnancy you do fasting and 2 hours postprandial, or you can do 1 hour, but the traditional is 2 hours postprandial and should be less than 120. So outside of pregnancy, meaning immediately postpartum, yes, there is value to switch over from the 2 hour postprandial check to doing fasting and pre-meal before eating glucose evaluations. And that goes for patients with type 1 diabetes as well as your type 2 diabetes patients, okay? See, I almost said type 2 diabetics. Type 2 diabetes patients. Ooh, almost fell into the hole there. So, yes, postpartum, there is value. The most traditional outside of pregnancy is to check fasting and pre-meal values as an initial target. So, guys, here's the catch. That's the initial target. And then once you get to target goal of fasting and pre-meal of anywhere from between 70 and about 95, and you target that, you keep that for about 3 months, then check a hemoglobin A1C. And in those patients, whether they have type 1 diabetes or whether they have type 2 diabetes, if you're at pre-meal goal, but your hemoglobin A1C is still not controlled, if it's still elevated, now you target postprandial values. Because here's the catch, you can't forget postprandial. Postprandial values do have a benefit here to check, because there's evidence that long-term metabolic dysregulation, complications of the metabolic syndrome, and even sudden metabolic cardiovascular death have to do with persistent, prolonged 2-hour postprandial hyperglycemia. Okay, so should you be checking pre-meal or post-meal glucose evaluations on patients who have type 1 diabetes or who have type 2 diabetes and are now postpartum? The answer is yes, it is pre-meal. Fasting and pre-meal is best. That's first target. Get that at goal. And then if the hemoglobin A1C does not move, your next goal is to target postprandials. So it's flipped in pregnancy. In pregnancy, we go straight to postprandials because of human placental lactogen. So that's the handicap in pregnancy, is that when the patient has a glucose load, eats a meal, because they're already carrying a weight, they can't process this. They can't process that. And it's that post-meal hyperglycemia that's linked to macrosomia, need for C-section, and in some studies, even preeclampsia. So pregnancy pretty much is the only one who uses fasting and postprandial, and outside of pregnancy, meaning even immediately postpartum, it should be fasting and pre-meal checks. All right, guys, we're going to give you a bunch of references here in a minute, but the idea is everything matters. It matters what the fasting value is. It matters what the pre-meal value is for patients with type 1 or with type 2 diabetes. It matters. And it also matters what their postprandial is, just like it matters what their hemoglobin A1C means. So the truth is, everything matters. And that's why I said, in an ideal world, we would check 8 times a day, once in the morning, and then twice buffering each meal before and then after for 3 set meals, and then again at night. Guys, that's 6 times a day. The way we avoid all this, again, the easiest is to use a CGM, continuous glucose monitor. But if not, as the question was asked, now that they're no longer pregnant and it's not a gestational diabetic issue, then you go back to fasting and pre-meal checks. That's target number one, according to the American Diabetes Association. Get that pre-meal value correct, and then follow hemoglobin A1C. If hemoglobin A1C is not behaving, now you need to target the postprandial value. Because here's the catch, guys, that postprandial value is a big deal. That postprandial value, again, is linked to these potential future morbidity issues like consequences of the metabolic syndrome. Even if a person does not have diabetes, if they're just hanging out, they're good, like, I wonder what my sugars are doing. And they're like, oh, my goodness, my 1 and 2 hour postprandial seems to be kind of above goal. That's a bad flag. Okay. So without diabetes or with diabetes, postprandial values, what your body does due to a carbohydrate challenge, is a big predictor of future cardiovascular implications, adverse issues, and metabolic syndrome. And I'm going to give you the data here where it says that 2 hours postprandial values that are out of control, dysregulated postprandial glucose metabolism, huge, huge factor here, even for sudden death. Because your body can't deal with that metabolism, with that stress response in terms of eating. So if we're not going to ask our patients with those with known pre-pregnancy diabetes to do paired checking. Paired checking means pre-meal and then 1 or 2 hours postprandial together as the pair. Then you start by targeting the pre-meal values. That's not my opinion. That's not ACOG. That's not SMFM. That's the American Diabetes Association. That's ADA stuff. And they've had this many, many times throughout the years from 2004, another one 2007. Their last statement on diabetes care standards was in the start of 2023. And I'll post that link in our reference page. So they always, so they recognize one, that both values matter, right? Yes, it matters to have good pre-meal control, and it matters to have post-prandial control overall. Both of them absolutely matter, just like it matters to have good fasting values. But under these ADA recommendations, pre-prandial glucose is targeted first. And then when pre-prandial glucose is at goal, but hemoglobin A1C is not, then you target the postprandial value as we've already discussed, okay? Now, if you're worried about postprandial hyperglycemia, then obviously you don't wait, you know, for a while to check that. You just start checking it immediately or do a paired algorithm. Now, the question that's always asked as an academic discussion is, well, which value contributes more to hemoglobin A1C? I mean, what? I mean, yes, these are the kind of academic things that people discuss and has been published. Now, the short answer is all of it, because hemoglobin A1C is related to mean glucose values that glycosylates the hemoglobin. So it's both. But the truth is that fasting or pre-meal values or postprandial values, they do have a different role. So they both have a role, but they have different roles for hemoglobin A1C. And this is super interesting. This is just a little academic tidbit here, a little quinky dink of info here. So if your hemoglobin A1C has tighter control, typically like less than 7.3, 7.5, in this case, then your postprandial value typically is giving like 70% to the hemoglobin A1C. So good control typically means fasting hyperglycemia isn't that much of a deal. But if your hemoglobin A1C value is under poor control, defined as greater than 10, then that's typically meaning that you've got a problem with fasting hyperglycemia, because that typically a fasting hyperglycemia state is responsible, based on the literature, around 70% of the time when hemoglobin A1C is very high, and then postprandial values contribute to the mean plasma glucose like 30%. Okay, so hemoglobin A1C under better control, then that's typically you don't have fasting hyperglycemia. And postprandial is typically accounting for about 70% of that. But if your hemoglobin A1C is whack, if it's over 10, then you typically have fasting hyperglycemia, like 70% contributing to the high lack of control, and then the remainder due to postprandial hyperglycemia. And this has all been very well published. It's actually not new data at all. This was published years ago in 2003 by Monnier. And just the idea that hemoglobin A1C, yes, it's mean plasma glucose, but which how things contribute throughout the day, fasting or postprandial, actually depends on what that hemoglobin A1C value is. So remember that the higher the number typically means you're jacked with fasting hyperglycemia issues, and if your hemoglobin A1C is a little bit lower but still not at goal, like 7.5 or less, then typically that's a postprandial hyperglycemia issue contributing to the majority of that. Oh, wait. I totally forgot something. I told you I was going to let you know what topic I bumped in order to do this one, because it was a little controversial. Well, there's been some, and I'm not going to get into it now. I just wanted to tell you what will likely be coming up in another episode, but I don't know when, because I don't know if I want to really do it or not. But there's some whack stuff coming out about ovarian therapies. I don't know if you all have kept up with this, but wow. Now, one of them seems really legit. The other one is less legit, let's just say, okay? For the two main stories that have kind of come out and are kind of hot right now, and one is more controversial than the other, the one that's not controversial is that stem cells for ovarian rejuvenation seems to have worked, like in a murine model. Okay, that's a rat model. It seems to work in that they irradiated these little mice, basically nuked or cooked to their ovaries, and then transplanted stem cells, not platelet-rich plasma. That's a little different, but true stem cells, omnipotential stem cells, and they actually regained ovarian function. So, and I'd covered this in the past about platelet-rich plasma, which is not cellular. That's just plasma and angiogenic factors and growth hormone, growth factors and things like that. But that's no cells. How that's a little controversial. Some data says it does work for ovarian rejuvenation after a premature ovarian insufficiency. Others say it doesn't. Same thing across orthopedic literature. It's very controversial because there's no standardized way to do it. Has it worked for some? Absolutely. Is it mainstream? No. But that's platelet-rich plasma. I'm talking about stem cells, true stem cells, omnipotent stem cells that have been injected into animal models to try to wake up ovaries that have been cooked, like by chemo, or have been knocked out. And it worked. So that was going to be one of the topics. That's not the controversial one. The other controversial one is weird, where they're like, hey, let me harvest, now that you're healthy, like a healthy 21-year-old, let me take a little slice of your ovary. We'll just cryopreserve that, just keep it for later. And then when you start getting perimenopausal or menopausal, we'll take that healthy ovarian tissue that's your own and then re-implant it back into you. So that's called self-auto ovarian transplantation. That's a thing. It's not an endorsed thing. It is super controversial because there's like no medical benefit of that. And the side effect is like, well, wait a minute. You're cutting into a healthy woman's ovary just to save it maybe for later, to try to prevent a natural process that all women are going to go through, God allowing, they get to the menopausal age. Well, why? So that was, I was going to call this Frontiers on Ovarian Therapies. And I may still do that later on, but that's basically what I bumped to do this. So stem cells seem to have woken up ovaries in an animal model. Cool. Maybe for ovarian rejuvenation. That is still super novel, but I know there is some data on that with platelet-rich plasma, although it's not mainstream. So a little controversial, but not as controversial as ovarian transplantation to beat menopause. Wow, that seems like a lot of work. I mean, taking out parts of your ovary just to prevent a natural process of life is a no-go for me, unless there's some whopping data that says otherwise in the future. Anyway, just thought you'd want to know. That's what I bumped to do this episode. All right, everyone, I know that we focused on patients with pre-existing diabetes, whether it's type 1 or type 2, but now let's briefly talk about gestational and why we do postprandial checks there. Short answer is babies do better, right? There's better perinatal outcomes when post-fasting and postprandial values are checked. The goal, of course, for fasting is less than 95, and then 1 hour postprandial less than 140, or 2 hours less than 120. But this goes back literally decades. In 1995, one of the nicest papers that looked at this was from the New England Journal of Medicine. The title was Postprandial versus Preprandial Blood Glucose Monitoring in Women with Gestational Diabetes Requiring Insulin Therapy. So these are A2 diabetics. Remember, we switched now. We have left patients with type 1 and patients with type 2. These are patients with gestational diabetes requiring insulin. Okay, so patients with A2 GDM. And the lead author here was Margarita de Vesiana. Short of it is, they found exactly what we just said. Yep, targeting those that postprandial better control versus preprandial tended to do better in pregnancy. There's a second publication as we walk down this timeline, as we leave 1995 and look at August 2003, that was an RCT in AJOG. So remember, we're making the case here of why in pregnancy, postprandial values is defaulted to, and then once you deliver, you go back to preprandial. So remember, the 1995 publication was in patients with gestational diabetes that required insulin. And the reason they required insulin back then, because remember, oral agents weren't really a thing back then. It was all insulin if you were A2 diabetic. But now, in August 2003, there's an RCT in the Gray Journal, the American Journal of OBGYN, that took a look at patients who had type 1 diabetes, that they were pregnant, and it was the same question. Is it better, and these are type 1 diabetes patients, is it better to stick with the preprandial or to look at postprandial? And same thing. They found that even though they were pre-existing diabetics, it seemed to be better with postprandial prandial checks. Now, ideally, because they have type 1 diabetes, there would be a paired check, pre and then post meal. The first listed author of this study from 2003 that was an RCT was John Manderson. And by their conclusion, quote, postprandial capillary blood glucose monitoring in type 1 diabetic pregnancies, okay, so it said diabetic pregnancies, not diabetic patients, diabetic pregnancies, may significantly reduce the incidence of preeclampsia and neonatal triceps skin fold thickness, in other words, fat deposition, compared with preprandial monitoring. So if you have a patient who is who has type 1 diabetes and then gets pregnant, ideally, yes, it's fine to do both. That's the goal, as much information as possible. But the one that's tied to better perinatal outcomes seems to be the postprandial value. That story of in pregnancy, whether you're gestational or pre-existing diabetic condition, it seems to be that the lower perinatal morbidity is with postprandial targets being met. So if you're wondering, well, this is great, but what is ACOG's stance? Well, ACOG says in Practice Bulletin 130, which is the bulletin on gestational diabetes, we're going to talk about pre-gestational diabetic information here from ACOG in just a minute, but in Practice Bulletin 190, which is gestational diabetes, ACOG says, quote, fasting or postprandial blood glucose value should be under 95. So it says or, so take your pick there. And then it says postprandial blood glucose values of less than 140 at 1 hour and then less than 120 at 2 hours. Those are your glucose target goals, all right? So they do give for gestational diabetes, it's right in there. Look, you got to do fasting or postprandial. You can pick there. Most people do fasting. And then they don't have a choice for postprandial. It includes postprandial, either 1 or 2 hours. So you've got, I guess, those options there. So ACOG and the ADA for gestational diabetes say what's non-negotiable, you got to check postprandial. Whether it's 1 or 2, you pick, but you got to check postprandial. Now, you can either check fasting or postprandial. So you got some leeway on that front. But after the meal, that's where the morbidity happens. So that is ACOG Practice Bulletin 190, all right? Now, if you go to ACOG's pre-gestational diabetes, the wording, remember, words matter, the wording here is different. ACOG's bulletin on pre-gestational diabetes is number 201 that was last updated in 2018, but reaffirmed just last year in 2023. The words that they use here are super important because here's what they say. Glycemia goals generally include fasting and pre-meal glucose values of 95 or less, and either a 1 hour postprandial of 140 or 2 hours of less than 120. Did y'all get that? Remember, in the gestational diabetic practice bulletin, it says fasting or pre-meal and then postprandial checks. But for pre-gestational diabetics, it says that the glycemia goals are fasting and pre-meal, implying you need to check both as well as the post meal. So to be clear, because of the added stress of human placental lactogen, while with GDM, you can do fasting or pre-meal and postprandial checks. If you have pre-gestational diabetics, ACOG says you should ideally do fasting, pre-meal and post meal, and then again at night. That's why continuous glucose monitors, CGMs, not a sponsor, are great for these patients because that's a lot to ask. But you need to know those words. In gestational diabetes, it's or fasting or pre-meal. In the pre-existing diabetes, it's fasting and pre-meal. Both values should be under 95 in addition to the postprandial values, either 1 hour or 2 hours as checks. Yes, of course, I'm going to list all of these references. Relax. All these references will be in our reference page, but those are the two ACOG documents. It's Practice Bulletin 201 and then Practice Bulletin 190. All right, let's start wrapping this up because I think we've already said a lot. So the short of it is, in pregnancy, postprandial values seem to be the ones that are greatly linked to perinatal morbidity. If a patient has type 1 diabetes and is pregnant, then ideally it is fasting, pre-meal, post-meal as a paired check, and then at night. If a patient has type 2 diabetes and they're pregnant, it follows the same kind of logic. It's the same thing. If they have gestational diabetes, then it is fasting and 2 hours postprandial. Now, postpartum, once the patient delivers, then you would treat them, obviously, as a no longer pregnant patient. And you can ideally go back to QAC, pre-meal, and QHS, and at night values, although the best would be to do fasting and then pre-breakfast, pre-lunch, pre-dinner, as well as nighttime QHS checks. It's not wrong to check in a GDM patient, keep checking their postprandial values, although in that case, the human placental lactogen stressor is now gone. So it's totally okay to check them QAC and QHS in this population as well. But it's not wrong to check it postprandial. It's just probably more accurate if you're worried about glycemic control, if you're going to check them postpartum at all, to check them pre-meal, okay? So the original question from our podcast family member is, in a patient with type 1 diabetes who now delivers, should we be checking pre-meal or continue postpartum checks? Because of postpartum checks was greatly tied to perinatal outcomes, and that's no longer an issue. She's now postpartum. It defaults to the first target, according to the ADA. First target is getting pre-meal sugars under control, then checking hemoglobin A1C, and then targeting postprandial checks, knowing, of course, that postprandial hyperglycemia is a big independent risk factor for future metabolic consequences and even early cardiovascular death. One last clinical pearl before we close up shop here. Remember the rule of 30s for hemoglobin A1C. If you don't know what I'm talking about, I think I posted that on Instagram some time ago. But the rule of 30s is a super easy way to correlate what a hemoglobin A1C value is to the corresponding mean plasma glucose. And so here it is, super easy. You start at hemoglobin A1C of 8, just because at 8, you'll always remember that the mean plasma glucose is 180, okay, 180. So hemoglobin A1C of 8 means or correlates to a mean glucose value for the last 3 months of 180. Then for every number up or down from that, you change plasma glucose by 30 milligrams per deciliter. So if a hemoglobin A1C of 8 equals 180 mean plasma glucose, then a hemoglobin A1C of 7, so go one up, is 180 minus 30. That means a mean glucose value of 150. If the hemoglobin A1C value is 6, then it's minus 30 from 150. That means it's 120. And let's go in the opposite direction. If a hemoglobin A1C value is 9, then it's 30 added to the 180 mean plasma glucose of hemoglobin A1C of 8. So that means it's 210. You see what I mean? So if you always remember, hemoglobin A1C of 8 means plasma glucose value of 180. Then the rule of 30 says for every number up and down from that hemoglobin A1C value, it is plus or minus 30. Before I close this out, to that podcast family member who sent me that voice message regarding this issue that became this episode, thanks for this wonderful idea. I hope this made sense. Send me a message through Instagram or Facebook that you got this and this is what you're looking for. All right, let's bring it home. All right, podcast family, that brings us to a wrap. As always, we're thankful for you, and we're glad you're part of our podcast community. We'll see you on another episode of Clinical Pearls.